This past summer, Dawson Forest Ranger Joe Langevin did what many of us would like to do. He traveled the Yukon River from Dawson to St. Michael by small boat. Joe, how long did it take you to get from here to St. Michael?
It was 19 days on the road, Ethel, and we left here on the 19th of August, and we arrived at the 7th of September at St. Michael's, giving us a total distance of 1,567 miles, which was very enjoyable.
Joe, had you planned this trip for very long? Was it something you just made up your mind at the last minute to do?
No, I had thought of this many years back. I first arrived in the Yukon in 1946, and I went back out to Alberta and Northwest Territories. Then I come back in 1948 and was stationed at Minto with the government. And I looked at the river and really wanted to do this trip, and met up with another chap, and we decided we would do it in 1949. But he didn't come back to the Yukon, so that left me without a partner. In 1950, I transferred to the forestry, which I was stationed in at Haines Junction, and I remained there for 11 and a half years, and then was posted in Dawson in 1961. And again, I saw the Yukon River, and it was my ambition to make this trip. Well, this year I had the opportunity of doing so. Although we had a heavy fire season, I managed to get away and had permission from my superintendent, Mr. Merrill, to do this trip.
Joe, you really stuck to your dream of going down that river. It did take you 20 years to get around to it. So you did have to make some preparation. What sort of a boat did you have, and gear and food? It must have taken you a few days now to get this all together, didn't it?
Yes. Last year I'd definitely planned the trip with my wife's uncle, a chap from California, and he said that he would make the trip with me, but due to conditions he was unable to come up here. But I had by this time purchased a boat, which was a 16-foot hull with a 68-inch beam. I purchased a 35-horse Mercury motor, complete remote controls, and all the gear that I could possibly get onto this motor to make the trip as comfortable as possible.
Did you feel that you didn't need a particularly heavy boat, Joel? It isn't a dangerous trip in the sense of really bad water and one thing or another, is it?
No, it's just straight forward. It's a very nice river to travel. It's really very, very good to travel. The water is excellent, particularly the time we went down. We did get into very high water, particularly below Fort Yukon. And the trip was really excellent. We had no trouble whatsoever, except for the changing of a few spark plugs in our motor. It was really good traveling.
Did you feel you had to take a lot of food along with you? I suppose you'd have like a first aid kit and extra clothing and the like, but did you have to prepare in the sense that you may not find many places to restock?
No, we had made quite a few checks to see where we could purchase food, and we found out that the stores, or small little stores, were on the river at approximately 85 miles apart. We had to purchase gas. Gas was our biggest worry in the whole entire trip. Food was not too bad because we carried approximately 2 weeks of food with us. We had a small propane stove, which done our cooking on. It was right in the boat. We had two little bunks in the back of the boat where we slept, and it was really comfortable. The boat was completely enclosed, and we had no trouble whatsoever. We carried maps with us and flare kits, a small radio which we could not transmit on, and was just a receiver.
Did the same rules apply to you, Joe? Did you have to check out with the RCMP here and give them an approximate time when you were leaving and when you expected to arrive at your destination?
No, because the first part of the trip, the first part of the trip is only 104 miles in the Yukon Territory, and from there on we were in Alaska, and it was up to the Alaska authorities to check us if they so wished. But they never checked us at all. We went through customs at Eagle, Alaska, and we had no problems at all. We didn't encounter nothing at all, really speaking. The nicest part of the trip, really, if I could go back a little bit here, in 1948, I left Whitehorse on May the 29th on the Kaska, and we come down the river, Lake LaBarge. The ice was still in it. We broke through the ice with a large barge, and this proved out to be a very interesting trip coming down to there. I stayed at Minto for several years and transferred to forestry when I come to Dawson, and we took another boat, a small boat, and I run right through to Dawson. And this was again very interesting, seeing the whole river right from Whitehorse right to St. Michael's.
Oh, yes, this is, now you've done the whole route. Just generally speaking, Joe, before we go on to the actual trip, is there a lot of game in the country? Would you recommend it for a man who was interested in actually hunting?
Well, yes. As you realize, traveling in a very small boat, you're down below the banks, we might say, and we did see quite a bit of game, like some moose and bear. As we got low down on the river, we saw a lot of birds, such as Canada geese, ducks, mallards, and yes, I would say it's a very good hunting country. Possibly a little time would have to be taken to bag your moose.
But I imagine your particular interest, Joe, would be photography, and this is a photographer's trip, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Very truthfully, it is. If you take an interest in all of the things that you see along the river that makes good pictures, such as old cemeteries, old buildings, and some mining along the river, and digging up the history of the country, photographing it, I think it's very, very interesting for a person to take pictures. And I find it very good for this purpose.
Is it a lonely trip, Joe, in the sense that there aren't too many communities or river travel or anything?
I would say not, because traveling like we did, we were traveling about 18 to 20 miles an hour. Our average day's travel was about 5 hours. So this put us in a community pretty well each day, although we didn't stop overnight in the community itself. We would stop 3 or 4 hours, pick up a few supplies, gas and oil, and proceed down the river maybe 2 or 3 miles and stop overnight. And the following day we'd get up and again go down to the next village and stop for 2 to 3 hours, take a few pictures, and move on to the next village.
Did you find many other people on the river traveling by boat?
Each day we would either meet somebody on the river, yes. They'd wave at us, or sometimes we would stop and exchange talks and take a few pictures and just discuss the river itself, to which were the better channels to travel. Everything was strange to myself and to Jim, who was along with me. So we would just stop and discuss the river and which were the better channels.
What sort of people would be on the river in the middle of the summer like that?
The first group that we met, it was a bunch of fish and wildlife officers who were checking on birds, banding birds, and generally checking wildlife in itself. There were three boys. They had a huge flat bottom boat, two kickers, and they had been on the river for some time. And they had told me that they had been up as far as Old Crow with their river boats that summer, just banding birds.
And then you meet holiday people, do that? They were doing it for the same reason as you were, just for the fun of it?
No, the only person that we actually met was a couple from Anchorage, and they had an amphibious car, and they had come down from Whitehorse on the flotilla and continued to Eagle, Alaska. And we saw them constantly for our first 100 miles back and forth. We would pass them, we would stop, and they would then pass us, and it was sort of a tag game with us for the first 100-150 miles.
This must be rather a shocking sight out there in the middle of wilderness to see this little car gadget, isn't it, Joe?
Yes, it certainly was. We're just down below Dawson, about 60 miles or 50 miles, and suddenly I said to Jim, I said, I wonder how that car got over on the riverbank there. Well, Jim never thought of this car being over there, and he looked at it, he said, I wonder how it did get there. Well, I says, it come down the river, I says, by its own power. They stopped the night there, and we went on down to 40 mile, swung around into the 40 mile river, and the following morning they come along up the stream, up the 40 mile, and come in and had coffee with us, and we then all started out pretty well together down the river to Eagle, Alaska.
So, Joe, we have just sort of started an outline of how you prepared for your trip, and just generalizing about this tremendous 1,500-mile trip you took. So possibly we should continue it next week, when Joe Langevin will go on with his experiences of going down the Yukon River in small boat. And this is Athery Talick in Dawson City. Last week, Joe Langevin began to tell us about his trip down the Yukon River in a small boat. 1,575 miles, I think it was, Joe, wasn't it? So, Joe, we have sort of generalized about your preparation and the general country. All along the river now, there are these little communities. Do you think that the river had quite a population at one time, at least the river area?
Yes, it did have quite a population, Ethel. It was similar to that of between Whitehorse and Dawson, and I'm quite sure that there was quite a population, because you could travel 30, 40 miles and you would see little cabins, These, in some cases, were where miners had worked, prospectors had worked, with some of the old gear left behind, steam points, boilers, many things to indicate that miners had worked on the river, and trappers also had been along the river, fish camps along the river, and there was a lot of traffic on the river. And talking to some of the people, they spoke of coming up as far as Dawson, some in small little boats and some working on the stern wheelers or paddle wheelers.
And generally speaking, the what is the country like between, well, are you, from where we can see here, it looks like the canyon, the walls are quite steep, Joe. Does this go on for quite a ways down?
Yes, it does. It's, say, starting from Whitehorse right to Fort Yukon, I think, is a much the prettier part of the river. There are large sort of canyon walls, and the river is pretty well in one channel, although there are a few islands. But it's pretty much in one channel, like, and this makes navigation very, very easy up to Circle. It's very, very pretty. It's sort of mountainous country, and at this time of the year, it was extremely pretty with the fall colors coming in. Our weather was averagely good in traveling, so we did get a few good pictures along the route.
You're speaking of cabins abandoned. Well, of course, what comes to my mind mostly are the communities like 40 Mile, Eagle, Circle. What is left of these places, Joe? I mean, they were good-sized towns, weren't they?
40 Mile in the Yukon, it's completely abandoned, I would say. Then you get to Eagle as the Indian village. I don't know just the population or the number of Indians would be there, but at Eagle itself, the white population isn't very much, five or six. And at one time, this was quite a large population here. It was still classified as a city, although there are only five or six white people there. Then we went down the river from there. We stopped at little cabins and looked around. Cold Creek was quite a community at one time. Woodchopper was another. These are all now abandoned. There's no one at all there. They're just cabins that are pretty well abandoned. People drop in and continue on. There's no one about them at all.
Joe, you mentioned Coal Creek. Is this where there was a coal mine at one time? Is this where the equipment is left over from the railway or something?
Coal Creek that we speak of is the one that's in the Yukon Territory. This is in Alaska and well down. I don't think they mined any coal there, although there are coal deposits. At the present time, they are still placer mining there, about 15 miles up Coal Creek itself. There's still a small placer mining operation in there. But there is coal there, but I don't think they ever mined it.
What about these little engines and this little railway setup? I've heard people mention that's something to do with some mine or something, isn't it?
Yes, this is just down below 40 Mile in the Yukon Territory. And there are still three little motors there, three little steam engines, flat cars, and quite a little bit of stuff, although it's pretty well rotted. You might say all the timbers in the flat cars are completely rotted out. It would be very hard to move out.
Oh, I was wondering if we could get them up here, but you don't think that they could stand the moving about?
No, you couldn't. I don't think so. You could rebuild them again, but this would be very costly to get the material to rebuild them again. It'd be very, very costly to do this.
Well, Joe, Circle City was a city long before Dawson was ever thought of. It had a population of 8,000 to 9,000 people. Is there anything there now?
Circle City has, I don't know just what the population would be, but approximately 100, 150 people. There's a road right in from Fairbanks to Circle City. The hot springs are just a short distance out from Circle. And this was a very nice little community. They had a very nice store, a very nice restaurant, and it was a very nice little community here. We rather enjoyed our stop. We arrived there at about 7 o'clock in the evening and went into the cafe and had something to eat and just generally browsed around the little community. The next morning, we had thought of getting away at 8 o'clock, but we didn't leave there until 11.
Are they more or less set up for tourism then, Joe? They just haven't given up the ghost just because their mining is gone, is that it?
No, there are quite a number of tourists come in there, simply because this is where you cross the Arctic Circle, and the tourists definitely do come in there with cars and campers.
What about the native people, Joe? How do they get along now?
Very well. We didn't see too many native people at this particular little at Circle, although there were a few around, although we didn't see too many. We mainly stayed around the store and where the chap was working, the manager of the store, explained to us his community and how it operated.
Mm-hmm. One thing I was going to ask you about, Joe, I understand that they use the fish wheels more on the Alaskan side. Where did you first start noticing these used to any extent?
Leaving Circle, we start to come in what they call the Yukon Flats. And this is the distance from Circle to Fort Yukon. It's approximately 160 miles, I believe, something about that mileage. Just above Fort Yukon, we started coming into some large fish wheels. Just below Fort Yukon, again, there were quite a number of large fish wheels. They were exceptionally big in comparison to what we have here in Dawson. And they were doing quite well in fishing.
Do they use these commercially, or is this just for their own local use? There'd be quite a large poundage of fish, wouldn't there, with the big wheels?
Yes, they commercialize on this to a certain extent. They catch the fish and prepare it, smoke it. And as you get on down the river, there are small little canneries that can the fish. They cut it in strips and smoke it, which brings a very good price, as much as $1.90 a pound for this stripped salmon, which is very good too.
I wonder why this hasn't been done upriver. I mean, is it because there aren't there many fish up here? What is the reason, Joe? Have you any ideas of your own?
I believe it's the quality of the fish. I think when they've traveled up as far as Dawson, that the main fat off the fish is pretty well gone, and the fish now becomes a little thinner, and the oil and fat isn't there to smoke a fish properly. And I noticed this going as we went down the river further, the salmon sort of improved, and the stripped salmon seemed to have got oilier, and it was much better in flavor also.
Is that right? I just wondered why that they, because I've heard of this smoked salmon that's quite a delicacy out in the stateside. Then after you left the you didn't even leave the Yukon Flats, Joe. This, I suppose, is one of the most wicked parts of the whole river, isn't it? I've only seen it from the air, but it must be almost a nightmare when you're right in the middle of it. Maybe you'd like to describe just what it is like, the Yukon Flats.
Yes, it is quite a nightmare because the river is very wide at this point. In other words, it possibly as much as 40 to 50 mile in width. But this is just a mass of islands and channels that you just can't make up your mind which one to get into. In one particular case, we're going from Circle to Fort Yukon. We went down about 8 or 10 miles into this one, what we thought was a proper channel. We finally found out that we had no water under, so we had to turn around, come back up the river another 8 or 10 miles. And of course, traveling with a boat and burning 3 gallons of gas per hour, one has to be very, very careful not to get in too many of these binds because there's just no fuel along those islands at all.
You could spend a lifetime wandering around those islands. Are the channels marked at all?
There are no markings whatsoever. There's nothing at all to indicate a channel whatsoever. And this makes it very difficult, but with very few boats on the river, it's hardly worthwhile to put up markers.
Well, did you have a river map or anything, or how did you manage to finally select a channel in this maze?
Well, it seemed to sort of fall in my mind that you should stay on the right-hand side because most of the villages were on the right-hand side of the river. So leaving Circle, which was on the left-hand side, I swung over to the right-hand side of the river, and I sort of more or less took this as a guidance, watching the banks, the islands, and trying to determine just what were the better channels. And this sort of proved out quite satisfactory.
You know, Joe, this is so interesting, as traveling down the Yukon, that once again, we have used up most of our time allotment for this week. So maybe if we can take one more time at it, we will get us at least down to the mouth of the Yukon River. And we have been talking with Joe Langevin, who made the trip by boat down the Yukon River from Dawson to St. Michael. And this is Athery Talick in Dawson City. The past 2 weeks, Joe Langevin has been telling us about his trip down the Yukon River in a small boat. So, Joe, after getting out of the Yukon Flats, it must have been with a great deal of relief that you finally got back onto a river with only one channel again. Did you have any general observations to make about the Alaskan Indian villages that doesn't apply to Canadian ones?
Well, in some cases, some of the natives along the river had been taken out and had been sent to Montana to where the fires were out of control in Montana and Oregon. This to me, I thought they had flown them a long distance, where in the Yukon, possibly we might pick somebody up in Whitehorse and fly them to Dawson or transport them by bus. But here they flew them all the way from these little villages along the river all the way to Montana and to Oregon and into the states to fight forest fires. This was rather unusual to me to transport men this distance. Mm-hmm. And also along the rivers, you might realize that they more or less depend or like their salmon. Of course, so bales of salmon had to go along with the aircraft, so they would be contented in their firefighting work. And where our natives up here prefer T-bone steaks, I think, in regards to dried salmon.
Then this would be an income of a village pretty well, then, would it, for fighting forest fires and going out to the steaks?
Yes, this is very much so. It's becoming more so to them, and they sort of depend on this. They'll be flown all over Alaska to the south, and wherever there's a forest fire, they'll come along the Lindyat villages and with an aircraft and pick up 10, 15 men in each of the villages if they possibly can and fly them out to a fire.
Mm-hmm. Joe, you're getting pretty well downriver now, Tanana, one thing or another. Did you run into any people or any old-timers who had been in the Klondike?
Yes, we met a chap by the name of Wolverine John. I don't really know what his name was, but that's what he was known at. And he was here in 1902, and even before that. And he spoke very well of Dawson, Sulphur Creek, and Granville, and Dominion Creek. And he decided to go on down the river, and he remained around Fort Yukon. And he's about 86 or 87, sits on the riverbank and chats with everybody that comes along.
And Joe, when did you first start noticing the difference? There's quite a Russian influence, isn't there? I mean, is there any particular point where you realize the Russians penetrated? Is this very noticeable at all?
At Russian Mission, we noticed quite a change, although this was a very poor little mission. There was very little income at this particular village, and there was quite a change right here. After you leave the Indian villages and get into the Russian or Eskimo villages, I think the people were slightly a little friendlier. They seemed to come down and greet you and sort of a little friendlier, I might say, mm-hmm. than the upper part of the river.
Do you find any Russian names that they've retained?
Well, yes, but they're rather hard to pronounce, and we didn't make too many notes as to names, mm-hmm. although they... you can definitely tell that there is a Russian strain in there, by just observation of the people.
When did you start first running into Eskimos then, Joe?
Well, just above Russian Mission, I would say. This was about the first, and you could see there was a sort of a cross-section in here. And then from there on right down to St. Michael's, it was pretty well solid Eskimos. Mm-hmm. We found that they were very, very friendly. We would stop and talk, possibly pull the boat up, and the first thing one would say to you, well, you better come in and have a cup of coffee. And by the time you got in for your coffee, it was maybe 5 o'clock, well, you might as well have supper, this sort of thing, when their houses were very neat and clean, most of them having large families, and their houses were very, very nice. I really appreciated going into them and having a meal with them, because this was sort of part of the trip.
This was quite something you did quite frequently then, Joe, visited along the way. Then you would really get to know the people along the river, wouldn't you?
Yes, they're very friendly. They just come right down to the river. It seems like when the boat pulls in, they see it, and they just come down, and they're very curious to know who you are and where you're from. And the moment you mention that you're from Dawson City up the river, they seem to open right up and start talking about the early days, the stern wheelers, the paddle wheelers, or just anything. And many of them you would meet, some of the older ones particularly said, well, did you know so-and-so up in Dawson? I worked with him on such-and-such a steamer. I'd say, oh, yes, he still remains up in Dawson. And we'd get into quite a little chat like with these people, and we rather enjoyed this sort of thing.
Speaking of steamers, did you see any large boats in the lower end of the river?
We only saw three large boats on the whole entire trip, two large prop-driven boats and one paddle-wheeler, which took us very much by surprise. We didn't think there were any on the river at all, but we happened to come around a bend and hear this paddle-wheeler was chugging up the river, which really surprised us.
Joe, did you start to get just a little excited when, you know, by this time you're getting down close to the mouth of the river? This meant the Bering Sea. Now, it seems to me by these maps that we're looking at here earlier that you just don't come up to St. Michael and it's sitting on the riverbank. This takes a little doing, doesn't it? I mean, there's sort of a delta, and you have to find another channel, don't you, to get into a little open sea to get over to St. Michael?
Yes, you certainly do. At one point, the river was approximately 5 to 6 miles in width. This was complete open water, 5 to 6 miles in width. Here we took a right-hand channel, and we continued on this channel for quite a distance, matter of fact, about a day. And again, we had to switch out of this channel and get into a smaller channel again, which took us into Hamilton. And Hamilton, being one of the smallest little villages we ever got into, there were only two families there, an Eskimo who run the store and one other family. and this was a very small one. At this time, we were only about 20 miles from the ocean, so we were asking plenty of questions just to what the ocean was like and how far we would have to go out into it, and these sort of questions.
What about the tide, Joel? How far out does it run?
Well, tide water was coming in then on this on the river itself. We then got in closer. Within 6 miles, we stopped at another little store, and again, we asked many, many questions, and he said, oh, you won't have any trouble. There's a little bit of markers up there, pegs up or sticks up, and you stay on the right-hand side of this, and you go 100 feet, and you turn sharp right, and you won't miss the channel. Well, off we went anyhow, and we tried our luck at this. So we went out, and we missed the channel, got into a mud bar, turned around, come back up the river, and parked ourselves for the night, which I thought, well, this is where we'll stay. The tide at this time was also out, giving us shallower water. The tide is not too much there. It's about 4 feet. So we turned around, come back up the river, and it wasn't too long that an Eskimo and his son come along. And, of course, they stopped and were curious to see who we were and what we were doing. And so we told them who we were and where we were from. And, of course, I asked the question, will you guide us through this channel? And he said, oh, yes, we'll show you through this channel. We know it very well. So we started the motor off, and off we went with a great clatter. And we didn't go more than 400 or 500 feet. Eskimo was high and dry on a mud bar, and we were just as high and dry too, so this really created quite a fuss, because I could have done as well by myself, really. So Jim, my partner, he said, well, I guess we can't push this thing off of here very handy. So he took his clothes off, off come the pants, and jumped into the ocean and lifted and pushed and tugged, and I was pushing on the motor as much as I possibly could. We didn't do any damage to the prop, it was just silt and mud, but we managed to get off of this thing and started down right into the ocean. And well, we didn't go more than 10 miles, and we really hit a heavy, strong northeast wind, which, again, we couldn't make any time, and the Eskimo by this time was well out of sight, and so we decided, well, we better pull to shore. So we swung off to the right, and we couldn't get completely to shore, so we had to anchor out, and there we stayed all night on an anchor, and I'm telling you, the boat really did a lot of jumping and moving around all night. We didn't sleep too awfully much, but next morning we got up about 5 and checked the wind, and it had gone down, and again we started off right into the ocean part. Well, you couldn't follow the beach at this point. You had to get out at least a good mile to a mile and a half out away from the shore. It was due to shallow water, although the water had come up quite a bit with the tide in. We had to go by Romanoff Point and pick out another channel, and they call this a canal, which breaks off to your right, and this canal is 20 miles in length. This was rather hard to find because the mouth of the canal was only about 40 feet, but extremely deep water. So we got into this canal. Here it was again quite interesting. We started to see some of the old stern wheelers that had been abandoned many, many years ago. They were there, 5 of them, and they were high and dry, but there was nothing actually left of them. The paddle wheels were all broke off. The boilers were sitting up. I believe they were two-stack steamers, the same as the Julia B is, which is in Dawson here. Mm-hmm. And this proved out to be quite interesting at this point. Well, we went a short distance and we saw an Eskimo sitting on the bank. So again, we got out and asked the questions, how's the river ahead or this canal? So he advised it was very good, and the channel was marked up ahead of us into the ocean again. So we proceeded on into St. Michael's from here. Well, we didn't go more than 4 miles that we got into another crosswind, and the sea was really pretty rough at this time. We broke our windshield, and we were a little scared just to get into St. Michael, which we still had about 5 or 6 miles of ocean travel to do, a real crosswind, which was extremely choppy at this time. Well, we were very glad to get into St. Michael, so we parked our boat there and went up and introduced ourselves to the NC manager. And he was very interesting to see us, because I had been corresponding with him throughout the year, trying to find out as much particulars as I could of St. Michael and its general surroundings.
Well, it must have been a great sense of satisfaction, Joe, to actually have put your foot in St. Michael after that long, long trip. And as you say, the last part of it wasn't anything too simple either. Joe, would you recommend it as an outing for a man?
Yes, I would. From, say, Whitehorse to Circle, I would recommend this very highly, because this is the prettiest part of the river. It is extremely pretty. As you get further on down, the river comes into a delta. It's flat. It's disinteresting in some ways, other than that the river widens out so wide. This is the only interest that you sort of keep up And when you get down to the delta, again, it's a frozen tundra, and right a short distance from the ocean itself, there were about 18 inches of thawed ground, and the rest was all permafrost and streaks of ice you could see quite readily. Like,
it's a pretty grim country down there then, isn't it?
Yes, it is that. All you see are just little sloughs or potholes, and many, many birds, like the geese and swans, all types of birds down there. This is really their nesting grounds, more so than the Yukon Flats or even around Rampart, which I always thought that this was their nesting ground, was up around the Yukon Flats, but I found out that it was well below that again.
Isn't it an expensive holiday, Joe?
Yes, it would be. It's time you buy your motor and your boat, as you realize you can't bring the boat back up with you. And somebody said, well, what are you going to do with the boat? Well, I'll sell it. So, which I did do. I sold the boat down there for a good deal less than I paid for it. But I always say, well, you can't take a wing off an aircraft when you come back. Like if you fly with an airplane or an airlines, you don't get any part of the airplane. But I managed to get my motor back home again.
Mm-hmm. And you were 19 days going down, and how many coming back?
Well, we're at St. Michael's, and we spent 4 days at St. Michael's, which we enjoyed very much. So into St. Michael's, the aircraft only flies in there twice a week, which is on Monday and on Thursday. This is a two-motor job, and Monday we happened to miss because it was a small cat on the airfield, and the pilot wouldn't land in there, so it was our job to get this little cat off of there. It was broken, and so we had to patch it up. No one seemed to know too much about it. So we fixed it up a little bit and got the aircraft off. So the pilot came in the following Tuesday and pulled us out, took us over to Nome. We arrived at Nome at about 2:30 in the afternoon and got a hotel room as usual. And the first thing, of course, is a shower, clean up and everything. We hadn't had a bath except a steam bath we'd had at St. Michael's. And this was quite an experience in itself. Not to elaborate on it too much, it was an Eskimo setup, and it was not too clean or tidy sort of a place, but we didn't get any bugs or anything, so we were very fortunate possibly, but I don't think there were any around anyhow. Now we're in Nome. We spent there 2 days in Nome, and we then charted out of there. We went to Kotzebue, which is again well over the Arctic Circle and only a short distance from Siberia, and we didn't stop there too long, about 1 hour, and then we headed for Fairbanks. Mm-hmm.
And so, Joe, within a matter of a few hours, actually traveling time, you were back home again. And would you do it again?
Oh, yes. If I had the chance, I certainly would possibly change around for a different boat. And several little things. You always see an improvement as you do these sort of things. But we were very, very happy with the boat we had and our supplies. We had good food, and we really enjoyed the whole trip throughout.
And thank you very much. And we've been talking with Joe Langevin, who made the 1,500-mile trip from Dawson to St. Michael on the Yukon River. And this is Arthur Retallick in Dawson City.